I regret everything, almost everything, because there have been so many mistakes and so much time wasted and so on. But, you know, that's life. You can't be successful all the time. Only a tiny, tiny bit of the time can you be successful. So I regret almost everything, but that's in the past. I'm looking to the future all the time.
That is biz. 商业就是这样。Hello everyone, I'm 文杰。Welcome to That is biz, and today's episode is a special show. We've told the story of Dyson's entry into China in the past show, and some of our friends have asked us to talk more stories about the Dyson company and Dyson himself. And now it's time. Last year, Dyson's founder and chief engineer James Dyson have written a new book, and the Chinese version of this book has recently have been released.So Dyson Company offered us a great opportunity to have a talk with James Dyson himself. As James is based in the UK, we asked one of our friends, Molly, she is in the UK, to do this interview. So say hello to everyone.
Hi everyone, I'm Molly and I'm studying business and management at the University of Reading. And I'm also a part-time business journalist and editor.
So today the main part of the show is the conversation between Molly and James Dyson.But before that, we still need a brief introduction to this company, for whom don't know much about James and the company he founded.
Yeah, I'll talk a bit more about the Dyson company. It is best known for its vacuum cleaners, purified fans and hair dryers, which are characterized by one main feature, pioneering technology. Chinese customers call them black technology. Dyson has a reputation for reinventing products.That people have taken for granted and winning commercial success. And James Dyson himself is not only the founder of the company, but he has personally led the invention of these products.
Yes, you mentioned the word reinvention. It's very important and interesting. So let's get started. At the beginning of the talk, Molly asked about the title of James' new book. James says in the introduction of this book that he originally wanted to title the book as James Dyson Failure. So Molly asked him,Why?
Hello, James and Molly. Such an honor to speak with you. This episode is a bit special because we are hosting James Dyson as a guest. He's a really influential inventor and entrepreneur in the world. And hi, James, a big welcome from us. Thanks so much for joining us today. And it would be great if you could say hello to our Chinese audience.
Yeah, thank you, Molly. Yes, hello to everybody who's listening. I'm looking forward to my conversation with Molly.
Yeah, some might be wondering why James is here. It's because recently James' autobiography, Invention Alive, has been published in Chinese. And the book illustrates James' story, including many failures, but defined by the products and core technologies he has developed. And I'd like to kick off the conversation about your invention journey by asking you one simple question. Why did you decide to write a new book in 2021? As I know, this is not your first book.
First, we had the first graduation ceremony of the undergraduates from our Dyson University, our own university on the campus here. And it caused me to reflect on my own graduation some 50 years earlier. And what I realized was that when I graduated 50 years ago, I thought experience was important. And I thought that it was important not to make mistakes and to do a lot of research.What I've learned is that now that is not, experience is not important because the world is such a fast-changing world. Everything in front of you is new anyway. You've got to provide new solutions to new problems. And I thought that would be encouraging for students leaving university to realize that, you know, they don't have to wait years until they've got lots of experience before they can start inventing things or leading teams or designing projects or deciding what to do.They can do it straight away, and that they don't have to wait for an experienced person to advise them what to do. They're just as able to make the decision as an experienced person. And that actually naivety and being curious and asking questions and not being a know-it-all is actually a distinct advantage. So I wanted to really write to say that, and a few other things as well, but that was the primary message.
Yeah, I was definitely inspired by your book, to be honest.
Oh, good.
Yeah, because I pretty much enjoy reading your stories that happened in just 1 year and also like happened decades ago. It sounds like it really close to us, and like the pandemic, like the fashion week in Paris you mentioned in the book. But however, the introduction caught my attention initially, like you wanted to name the book James Dyson Failure. Why?
Well, the life of a failure, indeed, the life of an engineer, and indeed many other professions, involves experimenting. And when you experiment, you naturally make mistakes. I wanted to emphasize that because at school, we're all told that mistakes are a bad thing and that failed experiments are a bad thing. You've got to get it right first time, and you're given the highest marks if you get it right first time. But I feel that it's far better to experiment and learn how to do things by your own discovery, where you learn it much more forcibly or viscerally because you've experienced the failure and you've overcome it. And I really wanted to point out to students and indeed people leaving school that failure's a good thing, not a bad thing. I mean, I'm always intrigued by failure. When I see a product not working, why is it not working? You know, that's really interesting. Whereas if a product works, oh, well, it works, you know, that's fine. You don't think about it. There's no there's no curiosity there. So I think that we should celebrate failure in schools and at universities and in life generally. And people always say now, you know, oh, there's lessons to be learned. I mean, it's not lessons to be learned. You've experienced what doesn't work and, you know, work out how to make it work. And that's what we all do. Writers, you know, what they first put down doesn't work. They have to rework it, maybe lots and lots of times.
Yes.
So it is with an artist. An artist often has to take out a lot of work that they've done because what they did originally doesn't work now. They've got to scrape it off and start again. And so it is with engineers and almost any walk of life. But failure should be an important part of education, learning to deal with failure and not be afraid of it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. As a journalist, we always say that good articles are edited and always like changed by the editors and the journalists. Otherwise, you can't make a great one. And I remember one of the most well-known failures that you made in the past, the backless vacuum cleaner. You tested it like 5,126 times. Oh, I can't recall the number.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you please share with us some of the most challenging and exciting moments when you were like trying to turn it into a commercial success?
Do you mean during the 5,127 prototypes or afterwards?
Yes, yes.
Right, okay. No, well, fortunately, I didn't know that it was going to be that many prototypes and tests in order to get it right. So perhaps if I'd known that, I might have put me off. But no, you're pursuing an objective. And, you know, some days you make progress, some days you go backwards, and some days you make an amazing discovery. The thing I really learned from it is that if you do the obvious thing, the thing that a professional would do, it usually doesn't work. You've got to do something obtuse, something that's wrong to make it work. So I often think that wrong thinking is a really good way to start when you're doing a series of experiments or any sort of form of creative act. Don't do the obvious thing, because that's what everybody else does. Do the wrong thing. I mean, deliberately make a mistake, deliberately fail, because it'll start you on a different path to everybody else.
But how do you view the legacy of a failure? Like, for example, like some of the motors, the cars, any prototypes which were not working as expected. How do you view that? Because, you know, like many people, they had failures in the past, but they just couldn't stand up.
Well, things can fail for all sorts of reasons. Not necessarily because the idea was bad or that your solution isn't good. So I think you just have to accept failure on the path to success. And, you know, I've got a few famous failures. Washing machine, commercial failure. Car was a commercial failure. If you always had successes, successes would be less precious, less valuable, and anyone could do it. So failure is a part of trying, is a part of trying to make changes, trying to invent, trying to create things. You just have to accept that there will be failures. And, you know, look back on them fondly. don't be shameful about them. It's not something to feel any shame about. It really isn't.
Do you summarize the failures that you had in the past and try to, let's say, convert it into your experiences, like to be the basis of your improvements?
I wish it were that easy. I mean, that's coming back to this point that experience doesn't really help you. I mean, failures are interesting, and massive commercial failures are interesting, and sometimes you can learn something from it. But it's really dangerous to always think that experience is going to help you in the future, because that's part of my message in the book, is that I really don't think it does.
Yeah.
Particularly in the modern world, in the world today, where there are so many changes every day. The political scene changes, all sorts of things change all the time. So you've got to intelligently look at what's going on and make a decision not based on experience, but based on assessing what's going on at the moment and coming up with the best solution in those circumstances. And, you know, one of the lovely things, and there's another reason I wrote the book, is that young people are passionate about really two areas that I've noticed with the James Dyson Award, is two areas. It used to be that people were passionate about helping old people and people with disabilities and the infirm.
Yes.
And they still are, but now what, of course, has come in is trying to use less energy, trying to make products last longer.
Sustainability.
Yeah. Solving sustainability and circular design and that sort of thing. And that's absolutely wonderful that young people are passionate about those two areas. As I say, about 20 years ago, there would be a lot of surfboards and windsurfers and skiing things, you know, sort of dramatic sporting things, as well as the disability and old people area. But now those have gone, and what they're interested in is solving issues for the infirm and old people on the one hand and sustainability on the other. And because they're so passionate about it, engineering is a wonderful way to actually do something about it. Rather than just talking about it or grandstanding about it, engineers and scientists can solve these problems. And the opportunities for young people to really make a difference and solve global problems is a wonderful thing to see. That's another reason why I wanted to write the book and stress the point about failures and stress the point that it's you, scientists and engineers, who can make a huge difference now.
Yeah, moving to the next bit, as you mentioned about like inspiring the young people, this part may be more relevant to your own opinions, but you have already shared with us many. So how do you lead the Dyson company to keep inventing new products?
Well, as I said, young people are really very inventive, if you allow them to be. I think as you get older, you get less inventive. I'm told that's true. I would hate to think in my case, but I'm told that's true. The experience takes over when you're 30 and inventiveness dies thereafter, whereas inventiveness is more powerful when you're in your 20s. But I haven't really found that, to be honest. And I hope that I attract to the company people who want to be creative and want to invent, because we allow them to do it. We want them to do it all the time. So I don't have to go on being inventive. I've got a whole lot of wonderful engineers who are being inventive, and all our ideas now are really their ideas, not mine. My role is one of encouragement and seeing that what they're doing is lauded, and I'm so enthusiastic about it in any case, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah, but as we all know that you are already an inventor, but are you inspired by some great minds? As you mentioned in the book, the key person, Jeremy Fry, and products such as Honda 50 motorbike and Citroen. I think you spend quite a lot on sketching those products and also like the great people in your book. So did they encourage you to be an inventor? Sorry for interrupting then.
Very, very much so. I mean, luckily, I grew up, in the 1940s and 1950s, which was just after the war, the World War, and a time of great change. You know, the jet engine coming in, vertical takeoff aeroplanes, very more and more sophisticated cars, washing machines coming in, refrigerators coming into houses. So I saw those huge changes going on. And there were great inventions. So the jet engine is, I think, one of the great invention stories. Everybody thought the technology would never work, that it wouldn't do what they were claiming. It was seemingly impossible. And yet, one man effectively made it happen. So that's a very, very inspirational story. And we have, the world's oldest running jet engine made by the inventor on the site, which engineers keep running, and we run it for visitors. We've got a vertical, just outside my office, a vertical takeoff jet, again, which everybody thought was impossible. And indeed, it is a very difficult technology to make work. And we've got a mini car. The Mini is, I think, the only car that's still on the road 60 years after it was invented and still as good looking and as good a car as it was 60 years ago. And we've got one of those sawn in half on our, so you can see how it's designed and engineered, how it's laid out. And that's really important to inspire everybody as they come to work every day.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I would prefer to have them in my office. I have the opportunity.
We've got a Concorde engine in one of the cafes, and we've got an English electric Lightning, which is the fastest aeroplane the RAF ever made, the Royal Air Force ever made. We've got that hanging in another cafe.
It's such a pity that I can't visit you in person.
Well, you're welcome to any time. But I mean, we're really lucky to have those wonderful pieces. And although we can never do anything as great as that, they do inspire us a little bit. That it's about being radical, being brave, and being bold and doing something that hasn't been done before and all those things. And it's just reminding us every day.
Yeah, I think you definitely have the potential to do a great one and hanging that up in your cafe one day, but in the near future, I'd say.
Well, I'm interested in the mundane. I like taking products that are quite boring and making them interesting. So I'm afraid I don't necessarily go in for glamorous products like mobile phones and things like that. I prefer taking wheelbarrows or vacuum cleaners or hair dryers, which seemingly are stuck in old technology and an old paradigm, and trying to change it.
Yeah, that's maybe it's a bit off topic, but I'd like to share the story with you because you've probably read about me. I grew up in a business-run family. Like, we run a family business, and my dad is kind of like an inventor, but he deals with the sales and marketing people. So when you mentioned in the book that you went to Japan and met one of the most partners in Japan, I just recalled my memory when our family went to Tokyo and my dad went to a fashion shop and he was like incredibly excited, and he showed me one product, said like, "We made this, we designed this." And I just asked him, "What's this?" And he told me it's kind of like a portable suit. So basically you fold the clothes and you fit that into a pocket. It's quite hard to do so because you can imagine if you have like a suit. What they did, not only himself, but the whole team, what they did is they invent a really special fabric to make it control. So I was kind of like shocked by that because I was probably in my 17s, probably 18, I don't quite remember, but I was shocked by his excitement. I mean, like, you made something and you wanted to show everybody that you did this and you wanted to promote that, to let everybody use it. I think this is what I kind of like feel the same from the book. So that's why I really want to share with you.
Yes, I mean, I think every inventor wants everybody in the world to use their product. You quickly realise that's not possible, but you've hit an interesting point. It is wonderful when you hear that someone's bought your product, and if they like it, that's great. And if they don't like it, that's interesting as well, because you get to hear why they don't like it, and that's really helpful to improving it or when you come up with the next model. It may sound like, showing off, but it's not about showing off. It's sharing something that you've done, a work that you've done. So it must be like an artist you know, having people look at his work of art. It's satisfying is the wrong word. I mean, it's really what you did it for. You did it for other people to use or other people to enjoy. If they have thought it was interesting enough to buy it and try it out, then that is flattering. But it's also why you did it. It's the purpose. It's your purpose in life.
Yeah. As I said before, my father probably did something like really small, but your early inventions like the sea truck and the ball barrel are like kind of like big things. What's the difference between like a big invention and a small one?
Well, no, your dad was invented a technology, a new fabric. Developing technology is always our starting point. The vacuum cleaner, it was developing the cyclonic technology to capture and separate the dust in a different way to a conventional filter or bag. And so it is with our electric motors that we've developed, which make all our products possible. These are motors that are four times faster than motors that have gone before. And, of course, much, much smaller, using and more efficient, using less electricity and being lighter and using fewer materials. We're developing new technology batteries. We're developing robotics, vision systems for robotics and all that sort of thing. So technology is always the starting point, and the engineering, the product come afterwards. And your dad was right. Your dad was right. He was inventing a new type of fabric to make his product possible. And that's really what inventors and engineers and scientists do.
As you said before, like the young people nowadays, they probably are pursuing to have, for example, helping the weak people, helping the disabled people, and also they want to make sustainable products. So my point is, as we entered an era, which is the era of the internet, why are there fewer huge and revolutionary innovations despite the increasing efficiency?
You mean in products?
Yeah, the products. Like, not only the products, but also the technologies. Like, we can feel like there are fewer revolutionary things. Do you have the same feeling? You can say that you have opinion against me.
No, I would say that people are spending more and more on research, and there is more research being done globally. But generally speaking, innovation is small steps. Sometimes new technology, when it comes out, isn't a great improvement on the old technology. But the second or third versions of that technology make a real difference, a huge difference. We found that with our electric motors. The first electric motor, a high-speed electric motor we did, well, it wasn't really any better than an old one. But then the second one was much better. And by the time we got to the third or fourth one, you know, they were streets ahead, and it was a radical innovation. But so what I'm saying is that these new high-speed motors didn't hit the market with a huge bang, and everybody's saying, wow, that's different. It happened gradually. But if now you look back on the 15 years or so that we've been launching these high-speed motors, you can see how it's radically changed everything. So our vacuum cleaners are now very small, and you hold them in your hand. The hairdryer is tiny compared with, and very light compared with previous hairdryers, and more efficient, and so on. So actually, they made a huge difference, and the products they go into are very different from the product that preceded it. But it didn't look like a revolution when we first started, in a small way, you know, in our field of vacuum cleaners and hair dryers and so on. So they're not jet engines, and they're not, even the mobile phone, you know, mobile phones started off, they were huge things, massive things.
Nokia thing.
And now, you know, they're tiny things. In fact, the problem is they're too small often, you lose them. We see the mobile phone as a big game changer, and indeed it is a big game changer. But, it didn't happen overnight. It happened slowly.
As we know, Dyson is now a multinational company, so you are not only operating in Great Britain, but also in Singapore, in China, and many places elsewhere. So how do you guys embrace a creative and innovative culture to avoid being too big, to avoid some kind of like inefficiency, I'd say?
Because we're a private company, so everything we do because we're fascinated by technology and love developing products. But we're not in a particular race to do it, and we're not driven by the city, by financiers and investment houses. So we can concentrate on developing technology and engineering products. That's all we have to worry about. We don't have to worry about investors and the stock market and all that sort of thing. So we're very single-minded in that sense.
Yes.
And the owners of the business, that's me and my son, and everybody that comes to work for us knows that that's what we want to do. So we have this passion for that. And I hope that that filters down. So it's not any great philosophy or any single mantra. It's how you behave every day that matters. It's how you encourage people, the bold decisions you make, the technologies you want to develop. All those things are what should drive success, in my view. So, but there's no, I can't give you a magic phrase as to how to be a success. It's not as simple as that.
Yeah, you don't have to give me a magic phrase, to be honest, because I think what you did in the past has already showed us Dyson's passion and Dyson's philosophy anyway. So is that one of the many reasons why you started thinking of educating young people? So you're thinking of that Dyson must run its own school.
I've been keen on supporting education. So we've invested money for buildings at Cambridge and Imperial College and the Royal College of Art and Design in London. And then I've gone to see every Secretary of State for Education saying that we need more engineers. The reason I've been saying that is that, of course, we at Dyson need more engineers. But now when you design a product, when I started 30 years ago, all we needed were mechanical engineers, essentially, because there was no software. There was very little, if any, electronics, no artificial intelligence. Now, when you develop a product, you have to have, of course, the mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, you have to have software engineers, you have to have AI, you have to have many...
Very specialized.
Five times the number of people to develop a product. Yet, we're producing fewer and fewer engineers. So I go to see every Secretary of State in Education and try to make this point. Of course, I get nowhere at all because they're government officials. But except that when I went to see Joe Johnson, when he had just been made Secretary of State for Education, this is Boris's brother, he said, well, start your own university then if you're worried about not having enough engineers.
Did he just say that?
He just said that. And I said, I can't, I'm not allowed to. And he said, I'm bringing through a bill in Parliament which will allow you to do that. Which, despite a lot of opposition, particularly from the House of Lords, he managed to do. So I said, right, well, we'll start our own university. And the reason I said that was that, the reason I had the nerve to say that and agree to do it, was that we've always had a policy of recruiting graduates from universities. So we have a very young corpus here. I think the average age is 26 or 27. So it already feels like a university campus. We also have a very broad range of engineering going on here, everything from battery development to robotics to artificial intelligence, a lot of software, of course, and motor development, heater development, all sorts of... It's a very broad spectrum. So I thought that we wouldn't shortchange undergraduates who came here because they'd get a very broad experience. So I had the cheek to agree to do it because of this broad experience, because we have a very young corpus. And also because I know that young people, in particular, people with no engineering knowledge at all, so we're getting...
That's me.
some people who come here are 17, they're literally leaving, they are leaving school. That they ask naive questions. And I think it's really good to ask naive questions. And
I ask any?
Well, I'm sure you will and you have. But they're good things to do. And so having some people who are not trained engineers amongst some of our very bright engineers and scientists, the best in the world, in my view, of course, would be really interesting because they would challenge them. And at the same time, they would teach them. So they work 3 days a week for us, and then they do 2 days of study, and we teach them on campus here. And they do it for this four-year course. So they do general engineering for 2 years, and then they specialize for the next 2 years. And the interesting thing is that we had a very, very... most of them got first-class honors, not marked by Warwick University, who doing our marking for the first
4 years. Corporated, yeah. Remember it.
And they, what they all say is that, and this is the really interesting thing, is we pay them, so they don't have any student debt. They don't pay any fees. And in fact, we pay them. They have a contract with us. So we you know, they're like normal employees. What they said was that because they're practicing their engineering, it really made them want to learn the academic side. And several of them said to me, if I hadn't had to apply my academic stuff, I'd never have bothered so much with the academic side and would have got a much lower degree. But because I've seen how important it is to know the academic side, that's really inspired me to do the academic side. And we get a lot of applicants who would have gone to Oxford or Cambridge or Imperial. In fact, we have 1,000 applicants for 40 places. We don't necessarily choose the ones who are most, who got the highest exam results at school, because engineering isn't just about getting good exam results. It's about being creative, definitely. Being determined, never giving up. It's about all sorts of character traits as well, curiosity. So someone who's got good exam results at school doesn't necessarily make a great engineer, or someone who might get a first in their degree course.
Referring to me, that I got not really good results at school, but I believe that I probably have been a bit successful in my career. So I definitely agree with you.
Yes.
And also, speaking of the first graduation ceremony, as you mentioned, probably at the beginning of our conversation, I remember it. So did you kind of like feel your educational concept has come true, like has been succeeded in some way?
Oh, yes, of course, it wasn't my idea. It was Joe Johnson. And happily, he was at the graduation. So I hope he was even more thrilled than I was. But it was a very moving occasion. I mean, one of the students gave a speech at the graduation, my wife and my son and I were all crying. I mean, it was very, very moving. But I think the experiment, and it was an experiment, has worked, and it's wonderful to see it working. Well, there are two really good side effects. One is that the students have no debt. It really upsets me that so many students come out of university now with this £50,000 or £60,000 debt hanging around their necks, which they have to pay off at a time of their life when they can't afford it. So that really upsets me. But I think also the fact that they're so motivated, motivated to do their academic work and their work at Dyson, but also the things they do in their spare time, you know, beekeeping, going and measuring pollution levels in London and Paris. They have a summer project which they do, which is not Dyson related. So from about now, for the next 3 months, yeah, they do a non-Dyson related project, and some of the things they do are wonderful. So it's just from my point of view and my son's point of view, seeing these inspired students doing so well academically, not having any debt, and throwing themselves wholeheartedly into making a success of engineering and their careers.
Yeah, I know that we are running out of time, but I do have 2 questions left and also a rapid QA session. I will try to wrap that really quick. And thanks so much, James. So the next question will be about the whole educational system. As we talked a lot about the university, about the Institute of Engineering and Technology, but as I know that you also have the James Dyson Award and also the foundation, how do you bring them together to work as a whole?
In a sense, they're all working to the same end. The foundation exists to fund medical research. So we fund cancer research, and various other things, including Alzheimer's. And then the educational angle. So we fund teaching in schools, buildings for schools, teaching in university and buildings in universities, and now of course our own university, and buildings in schools. So my old school now has what we call a STEAM building, where we put STEM education in one building with art and design and technology, to show that they're all creative subjects, design and technology isn't the own, and art aren't the only creative subjects. Physics, chemistry, and maths can be creative as well. So we called it a STEAM building. The James Dyson Award, we noticed that there are design awards for products that look good, but there was no award for technology that solves today's problems. So that's why 20 years ago we started this award, and we challenged people, undergraduates, to solve a problem. And in China alone, we're getting 6,000 or 7,000 entries every year. So it's a huge number of people who think they've got a problem that they can solve. And there've been, we had a very interesting winner from China, with someone who was robotically clearing up pollution in rivers, which is a great idea. We had a Philippine entry who discovered that certain rotting fruit, if you mixed it up and spread it on windows, you could generate electricity on windows from not sunlight, but just light. So he got a sheet of glass, and his concoction was across the glass, and he was charging his iPad from it. And he's gone on to commercialize that. And so many of the winners, and even people who didn't win prizes, have gone on to commercialize them.
Thank you so much for today's QA. And we've got a late Easter egg for you. It's a rapid Q&A, so you don't have time to think much about it, but just to quickly respond to me. So we've got like 5 or 6 in total, I'd say. So is there anything you were convinced of but are now beginning to doubt?
Yes, I think that applies to almost everything. Because, you know, we're in a changing world, and it's this point. You thought you knew the answers, but now things have changed, and you've got to find a different answer, and you can't draw from your experience. So I'd say almost everything.
Okay, but are you optimistic about the future of humanity?
Yes, I am, particularly if we trust young people and trust that, and also create engineers and scientists, as well as all the other wonderful graduates that we're creating.
Okay. What is the thing you regret most? Like you made a mistake and you wanted to change or something like that?
Well, of course, I regret everything, almost everything, because there have been so many mistakes and so much time wasted and so on. But, you know, that's life. You can't be successful all the time. Only a tiny, tiny bit of the time can you be successful. So I regret almost everything, but that's in the past. I'm looking to the future all the time.
What do you consider to be your most important achievement?
Creating
a university.
Well, just being determined and persistent.
How do you evaluate Dyson, as a brand or as a kind of spirit?
Much more as a spirit. I don't really think of the brand. It's the spirit. It's what our ambitions are, what we're trying to do. That's important. Develop technology and make better products. That's what we're trying to do. And that's a spirit, okay. Not a brand.
Yeah, I agree with you. Please recommend a book to us.
Invention
Alive or the others.
Well, okay. Well, since it's a quick fire, I'm just reading about Frank Whittle's life, the inventor of the jet engine. And it's important, even if you're not an engineer, to read it, I think, because it shows how wrong government policies can be and how important it is to carry on in spite of that.
Thank you for listening to today's ZBiz. You can subscribe our show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other podcast apps.
感谢收听这一期的商业就是这样。你可以在苹果播客、小宇宙、喜马拉雅、网易云音乐、QQ 音乐、荔枝等平台收听我们的节目。微信公众号第一财经 eMagazine 也会推送每期节目的内容。如果喜欢我们，欢迎你在苹果播客给我们五星好评，并期待你在各个平台与我们交流。尤其欢迎分享你感兴趣的话题，下期见。